Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, what do Wall Street's 1% think about the occupation? Is a new generation of activists getting an education in what it means to be homeless? And when is a strike not quite a general strike?
But first, faith-based organizations around the country are showing what they think about the big banks by withdrawing their money from them. The plan is for churches to take out $1 billion from outfits like Bank of America. We ask Reverend Ryan Bell of the Hollywood Adventist Church in Los Angeles if $1 billion can make the big banks blink.
That's a lot of money. It's a significant amount of money. And if our new bottom line coalition can move $1 billion, I think not only does that make a fiscal impact on the banks, but it's a message that is heard around the country. To accumulate $1 billion of transfers, you've got to get a movement, you know, and that's what's afoot right now. And I think even if bottom line wise the banks can absorb that kind of change, public relations wise, they have to pay attention. If people have moved $1 billion out of their banks, that's a loud and clear message, in my opinion.
And we always see Bank of America at the top of the list of the financial bad actors. Why is that?
I mean, I think they were a big part of the toxic securities issue from a couple of years ago that caused the crisis. The Attorney General of California is investigating Bank of America. So they've had some really questionable practices leading up to this and creating the crisis. Many of my members have lost their jobs and or had their hours reduced because the economy is suffering. And the economy is suffering because these large financial institutions, notably Bank of America and Chase and JP Morgan, were sort of gambling with our security. And so I think they do have to answer for their behavior. We're not trying to destroy the banks. We're not trying to put them out of business. You know, our society needs banks, but we're trying to reward responsible banks and just give our business to businesses that are being responsible. This is just the same way that we would do in any other kind of a business aspect of our lives.
One popular call is to break up the small number of very huge banks into smaller banks. But if all of them continue to deal in derivatives and other casino-like behavior, how does having, 15 huge banks rather than 7 really change that kind of situation?
The practices of banks have to change regardless of how many there are. I mean, that would be my sort of simple approach to it. I think we're talking about not just an economic issue, but a moral issue from our perspective. The new bottom line coalition, especially PICO National Network and LA Voice in Los Angeles that I'm a part of, I mean, the clergy and our members of our congregation see this as a moral crisis. And it's about greed, unchecked greed, at a time of corporate need in our communities. And so the practices of these banks, regardless of how many of them there are, have to change so that we're not simply accumulating wealth in the richest 1% while the majority of our community are suffering.
And how deep do the tentacles of big banks extend into the local legislatures, the city councils?
There's an ordinance before city council in Los Angeles to actually grade banks based on their social responsibility, and then the city would be instructed to move its short-term, you know, liquid banking into banks that are behaving responsibly, that are getting a good grade. And so that ordinance is before committee in a couple of weeks, and then if it passes out of committee, will be before the entire council. One of the things that I spoke about at the press conference a couple of days ago, just from a moral perspective, there's a parable that Jesus tells of a king who forgave a man a large debt, and he was in prison for his debt, and the king forgave him. And after he was forgiven, he went out to find his servants who owed him just a fraction of the amount that he owed the king. And the parable that Jesus tells says that he went out and strangled his servants for them to repay him after he had been forgiven so much. It's called the parable of the unforgiving servant. And it just reminds me of the way that the large financial institutions in our country have behaved after they've been bailed out by so much of our federal tax dollars and then have turned around to our families and virtually strangled them for the money that is owed to them. There have been cases where a family just needs 1 or 2 months' payment on their mortgage put on the back end of their mortgage, and they could keep on paying their bills, and the bank just refuses to do that, or just an interest rate reduction for a little while so that they can get through and resume their normal payments. And it just seems completely unwilling to do that. And it just reminds me of this parable of the unforgiving servant, the one who's been forgiven so much and been given a second chance, unwilling to give the people that owe them something a second chance. And it's just not fair, and it's not right. And I think that's why there's a moral outcry on the part of our members.
That was Reverend Ryan Bell in Los Angeles.
In the San Francisco Bay Area, we spoke with Reverend Mario Howell of the Antioch Church Family. He says churches can make a dent in the power of the big banks.
Good example. Most of your churches across America and the United States, we drop our money into Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and your major banks on every Monday morning. And you're talking about billions of dollars that even the church alone put into Bank of America in these big banks. Then you're talking about cities and counties and states that bank with these banks also. So our charge is to even convince city governments and our cities and our counties to pull money out of these banks who's not doing the right thing by the people that they represent. San Jose pulled out $1 billion out of Bank of America. It hit the news. I mean, other cities, and since I'm pastoring the city of Antioch, and me and Father Ring of a Catholic church, we pulled out $100,000 about 2 years ago, and that's what really started our campaign. So we're actually trying to tap into all the government officials in cities to say, do this, and if you don't do it, we're going to remember you when it comes time to vote again, you know. So we're putting the pressure on city officials to do this also.
Is there any organic connection between the Move Our Money campaign and the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Well, absolutely. It's all the same. I think all of us fighting for the rights of people. You know, there's people suffering in New York, well, they're suffering in San Francisco. It's jobs, it's foreclosure, and these banks have enough money to show more compassion than what they're showing. So it's a fight not just for the foreclosure and the housing, but it's a fight for jobs also. It's a fight for health care, it's a fight for many different things. And it's time for us to stand and rally together from all walks of life, and I think that's what's happening all over the country at this moment.
Do black congregations see this struggle against banks and concentrated capital in the same way as other congregations, or more intensely?
I would say no. I think what's the problem with black America and black churches today, we don't have what we call a clear leader, though we used to have when Martin Luther King was living. And I think some of the churches across this country, they so focus on their building and their surrounding, their church, and they have to go beyond the four walls, because if you look at the scriptures very closely to all the preachers, Jesus' work was never done so much in the church. His work was done outside the church.
And so the church's money might be looked at more in terms of return on investment rather than the social good.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I know that I probably get some slack behind this, but I've seen it with my own eyes in the last 3 years, trying to rally clergy together for these movements of foreclosure. They don't understand that families have been foreclosed upon, that means families within their own churches, if they're not involved in this movement, they're going to start to lose members. When they start to lose members, they're going to start to lose funds. When they start to lose funds, they're going to start to lose ministry. So it's a big picture, and they have to see the big picture. It's not just about themselves. It's really trying to help you people.
Reverend Mario Howell in Antioch, California.
Oakland, California is the epicenter of the West Coast occupation movement. Last week, protesters staged what they called a general strike, shutting down the port for part of the day. Scott Campbell is one of the occupiers. He got shot by a rubber bullet and says the police presence was anything but light.
No, certainly not. They came out in full force with hundreds of officers from a variety of departments from around the Bay Area and the state. And I was just taking some pictures and filming with my camera and was shot with a rubber bullet and had to leave the scene. But this was shortly after a group of people tried to occupy a foreclosed former homeless services base and to reopen it for the movement and for the people. And the police came in almost immediately after that with tear gas, and then were shooting some people, myself, and I know at least one other individual was hit with rubber bullets.
Your mayor, who had been rather aggressive against the occupiers, then backtracked. What do you think her position is now?
It seems like it changes every 3 days. I think that she has, well, certainly lost control of the situation, not really that it's up to her to control the situation, but by ordering the raid and then trying to pin it on, you know, other functionaries and on the Oakland Police Department, and then letting the camp back in, saying that she's part of the 99%, and then now unleashing more police violence. It's incredible. It's hypocritical.
Well, of course, misbehavior by the Oakland Police goes back many decades. It's what prompted the formation of the Black Panther Party in the mid-60s. Do you believe that the Oakland Police operate autonomously on their own, do what they want to do?
Well, you're absolutely right about that. I think that they're certainly very unhappy with the mayor. So it seems that they're taking actions that might not be in line with the mayor's office. Like you said, the Oakland Police have just a legacy of violence. I mean, if there's one thing that Oakland is known for, it's police violence. And I think they do act autonomously and they do act unaccountably. And I think the mayor and the police are really at loggerheads, and I think that that's contributing and probably contributed to the violence that we've been seeing from the police.
Being shot with a rubber bullet, does that deter you?
It only deters me as far as I'm mobile, but I'll still be out there. This is not going to slow me down. There's too much at stake.
And in terms of the mood of the occupiers who have doubled and tripled and quadrupled in number, do you see them being, that is your fellow occupiers, being in there for the long haul?
I think people are in here for the long haul. I think that, you know, especially after the camp was raided and there was the severe police violence, I think that folks have redoubled their efforts, realized the intensity of the situation, and realized the effectiveness of this movement. And the huge turnout for the general strike just reinforces that message. So I think folks are in for the long haul. I don't think we're going anywhere. And especially, you know, the more, last time when it came down on us hard, the movement doubled in size or tripled in size. And if they're going to keep doing it, the movement's going to keep growing. I don't know why they haven't learned that yet, but it's growing, and we're not going anywhere.
That was Scott Campbell, recovering from a rubber bullet wound in Oakland, California.
The occupiers called it a general strike in Oakland, but most people still went to work and school. So we talked to Professor Emeritus of History Melvin Dubofsky of the University of New York at Binghamton. Historically speaking, was Oakland a general strike?
Well, from my perspective, and what I know of general strikes, nothing about the situation in Oakland fits what is ordinarily thought of and seen as a general strike.
And how would you describe a general strike?
Not easy, because there's no agreed definition. For example, if workers in the steel industry or the automotive industry, one or the other, were all to walk out of work at the same time, that could qualify as a general strike. A general strike in the metal trades, or a general strike in the automotive trades. General strike sometimes has been defined to mean a citywide walkout in which all the employees in a given city simultaneously leave work. And then is the often, in some circles, dreamed of total and complete national general strike in which everybody that's employed stops work simultaneously. Well, none of that seems to be what happened in Oakland.
So we are talking about general strikes that are by sector or by geography?
In the history of the United States, the only strikes that might qualify as general strikes, Seattle, 1919, San Francisco, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Toledo, 1934, Oakland, and Rochester, New York, 1946. But all those strikes were called or conducted directly by the local labor movements. Usually the council, the metropolitan or city council, had represented all the affiliated unions. The Seattle general strike failed. The three general strikes citywide in 1934 all succeeded to one degree or another. The 1946 general strikes in Oakland and Rochester failed to achieve their loosely stated objectives.
And what do we mean by succeeded in the case of those citywide strikes that you describe as successful? What is the measurement of success?
What did they achieve? Well, in San Francisco, they achieved basically the unionization of the waterfront. And it was that strike that gave birth to the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union that negotiates for port workers on all the West Coast ports. The Minneapolis-St. Paul strike led to the recognition of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters there and was sort of the beginning of the really rapid growth in that union. In the Toledo case, it was striking auto-light workers whose strike precipitated the general walkout. And they didn't receive immediate recognition, but they obtained far improved working conditions. And within 3 years, they had a union contract and collective bargaining. But those were, you know, the objectives of those strikes.
So when we're speaking of general strikes, one of the prerequisites for even measuring the success of such an action would be that there be specific goals for the strike.
Well, I think there are two measurements. One is to what extent workers actually walk out. Because if you call a general strike and workers don't walk out, it's immediately ineffective. So that's the first measurement, the level of response. The second measurement is to what extent they achieve whatever prompted the walkout or general strike.
Professor Melvin Dubofsky is author of The State and Labor in Modern America.
The occupation movement in Lower Manhattan began as an overwhelmingly white affair, but has picked up steam along minority communities. Andrew Hoyles is part of the People of Color Working Group at Zuccotti Park. He believes non-whites are making their mark on the movement.
Well, I think we try to be a strong voice for our issues, our needs, or when racist stuff comes up in the larger movement, I think we're there first to respond to it. And I think that is because white people aren't going to bring up racism or they're not going to bring up disenfranchisement. So unless we claim these things as something that's actually happening, we make this known, then it's not going to happen. To say that we aren't working with allies, that there aren't other people who are trying to do this work as well, then that's a little, you know, I think there are other voices also who are trying to make it known that Occupy Wall Street isn't just one big happy movement, that there are other issues going on and they want to try to make their voices heard as well, which I guess I'm trying to get at. Other people are trying to be a voice as well that we would support, like our allies and such.
There are some who say that the occupation has a reputation of being overwhelmingly white because the media seek out white members of the occupation to interview.
Yeah. I would say that critique is a valid critique. I would say that media, especially mainstream media, is looking for, you know, oftentimes a white face. Oftentimes it's a white male, college educated, who's dealing with debt. That's a problem because debt is something that is a struggle. Debt is a struggle. But what's important, one of our viewpoints in the work that we're doing as a caucus is that it's the economic issues that people of color face didn't start with college debt. It actually, there's been much longer histories that we're dealing with. That's one of our other working groups within the People of Color Working Group. It's forming a press and a media subcommittee. So that's trying to raise our voices in those ways, be heard in that sense. This critique keeps coming up, and we're trying to do other things to make our voices heard. We're starting our own blogs. We have our own Tumblr page. We have our flyers and things like that, so that we can put this stuff out there that we're here too. If there needs to be another voice or another angle or another position when media companies are out there trying to get an interview or something like that.
There is also an anxiety among black folks in general that the 99% formula would tend to subsume specific black grievances within this larger mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that one of some of the hardest stuff that we're doing when we're out flyering and tabling, we might be out in Bed-Stuy or we might be in Harlem, and then some of the black folks that we're talking to, like, and then I'm black, and then a lot of the people in the movement that we're with are black, are kind of like saying, what are you talking about? Like, Wall Street isn't my issue, you know. I'm more worried about a job than Wall Street. It's difficult to talk about that because those are those intimate struggles that they're dealing with. And one thing that's important to kind of get out there is that people need to act up a little bit. People need to start to struggle. And if these issues aren't going to go away unless we raise up our voices, unless we start to get out on the street and become active in our dissatisfaction with the system, with how poorness is something that's more relegated versus more of a happenstance. It is a burning issue. It's very important that black people in America start to see Occupy Wall Street or see these occupations that are happening around the rest of the country not as a white issue. It's very much their issue. White people, whether they know it or not, when they're talking about the 99%, 99% isn't college-educated white men who are in debt. It's actually the people who have continuously been the first ones to be fired and the last to be hired. It's continuously been the ones who are even the worst signifiers, basically, of economic standings. People of color in the United States, black people and Latinos specifically, are at the bottom rungs of those numbers. So getting involved in this movement is very necessary if we're all kind of trying to change these things. We're going to try to get on top and reclaim some of what's rightfully ours.
That was Andrew Hoyle at Manhattan's Zuccotti Park.
There's no question it's rough being under the boot of a dictatorship of money, but it's not chattel slavery. Slave metaphors appear on some signs at occupations, but Black Agenda Report's Dr. Jared Ball says this is one metaphor that's got to go.
Of these recent occupations, Brian Bullock asked recently, if Wall Street didn't get a bailout, would there have been a bailout for the hood? And Kenyon Farrow described the race problem of these occupations and responded quite critically to the repeated use by white occupationists of the metaphor of slavery. Both have added themselves to a growing number of those whose views of these occupations are justifiably cynical. When Farrow described this abuse by metaphor, he was also responding to a long history of literal black suffering becoming metaphorical propaganda for white self-interest. So yes, violence, as H.Rap Brown once said, may indeed be as American as cherry pie, but the use of black suffering as a mechanism of white transcendence is as old as race itself and even predates the America for whom violence would become so essential. Hearing of and seeing the white-held signs calling for an end of our enslavement by Wall Street is in part why more and more are looking to challenge the language and the focus of these white Occupy Wall Streeters. The metaphor of an often misused metaphor demands it. As Patricia Bradley has documented, this metaphor of slavery became the leading tool of propaganda used by the white middle and upper classes to shape the public opinion of white colonists against England. In one fell swoop, their propaganda worked to aid in solidifying the status of enslavement to only black people, while only publicly discussing slavery as something forced upon themselves by the British. Chief among these propagandists was the slave-owning Samuel Adams, whose image now cleansed with the help of a beer brand brings new levels of appreciation for the Dave Chappelle Samuel Jackson beer parody.
Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell!
So the growing number of darker critical voices of the occupations have centuries of metaphorical abuse to add to the physical and are correctly noting the similarities. During his recent talk at Hampshire College, former Black Liberation Army soldier Ashanti Alston recalled his friend's experience at an occupation of being shouted down as divisive for trying to focus attention on black poverty and mass incarceration. Empire gets defensive, he said. It has no time for critiques of racism. It is this kind of increasing tension being reported in smaller, darker circles that reminds of this history of abuse by metaphor.
White colonists, not wanting to be reduced to the conditions of those they themselves enslaved, adopted the denunciations of slavery by the British in precisely the same way white middle-class settlers today decry their own semi-step downward toward those darker people they themselves enslave and with whom they want nothing to do. They don't want an end to slavery either. They just don't want to be forced any closer to those truly defined permanently as the real enslaved. So in response, there are those now calling for an Occupy the Hood movement, while others define their efforts as hip-hop occupies in a rise to decolonize. In fact, this group's goal is to embrace the term occupation as it has been reclaimed by militant workers of color from Latin America, Osaka, Buenos Aires, South Korea, China, among others, to describe their occupations of factories, schools, and neighborhoods to strike back against oppressive forces. Further, the Hip Hop Occupies Collective says that we fully endorse the decolonized framework as the necessary expansion, that in the face of brutality and the legacy of capitalism, a system that relied upon the enslavement of African and Caribbean peoples, the genocide and displacement of indigenous peoples, and the violent seizures of land for colonial profit, we embody a vision of intersectional social justice and self-determination. These are part, like the work of the Black is Back Coalition, of still not dead embers of a global majority's non-alignment with even liberal elements of the West. These are the signs of what may yet prove to be the most, perhaps only, redeeming value of these occupations, a radical, global, and organized response led by the colonized to what can only be the incompleteness of movements led by whites and liberals. For as Austin also said, this monster called the American way and democracy must fall. And its metaphors, too.
Dr. Jared Ball of Black Agenda Report in Washington.
UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, has emerged as the preeminent activist peace organization in the country. UNAC's spokesperson, Chris Gavreau, says the occupation movement and the anti-war movement are moving in the same direction.
Well, we're in absolute and total solidarity with occupiers from one end of the country, U.S., to the other, and all of those internationally. We are in solidarity with the Egyptian and Tunisian uprisings. We oppose the invasion of Libya, which was really a NATO assault to try to terrify the people who had risen up against the bankers in Egypt and Tunisia. And today, we feel that the effort to end U.S. interventions abroad, to end NATO attacks on nations who are attempting to fight back against the banking elite, are incredibly strengthened by the fact that a real economic justice movement is forming and developing and clearly part of the future.
What's up next for UNAC?
Right now, UNAC is focusing on organizing, fighting for permits, fighting for the space for political protests at a joint summit of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that is the preeminent military alliance that serves the banking elite worldwide. And they are meeting at the same time and in the same place with the G8, that is the heads of state, the finance ministers, the political forces who are implementing the austerity programs worldwide. So we can see that the fight against war and the fight against the austerity and cutbacks are one and the same in general, but very powerfully in this one instance in Chicago. And we know the whole world is going to be watching the people in the U.S. to see if we're capable of standing up and sending a loud signal to the world that we're part of the international struggle with them and we're standing with them against both the NATO and the G8, the World Bank, and the IMF.
It seems that Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel wanted to lay down the law to the Chicago occupation demonstrators in order to show that he's not going to tolerate any kind of disruption of his meetings of NATO and the G8.
Well, absolutely. It's absolutely true that the city of Chicago has not been welcoming of our plans to hold giant, massive, peaceful, legal demonstrations in Chicago. But we are not daunted. we're mindful of the fact that every time the G20 or the G8 or other forces try to meet Pittsburgh, Toronto, that all the political figures in charge who respond to the banks and not to us have done everything in their power to shut down the political space, the public space, in which we could begin to mount internationally visible protests. But we can't be intimidated by these efforts. We are beginning now, and we really urge everyone to join with us to launch a national and international campaign to demand that our right to protest is respected. We've joined up with Occupy Chicago, who just last week marched to City Hall with us and held an action inside City Hall to draw attention to the fact that the response to our demands for permits was to announce that they were assembling 13,000 police and training them in mass containment measures. So we're in solidarity with Occupy Chicago, their attempt to hold their space, defend their civil liberties, and they're in solidarity with us because we do intend to have a big international protest in Chicago between May 15th and 22nd. This coming spring.
That was Chris Gavreau of the United National Anti-War Coalition.
Polls show much of the nation shares the occupation movement's views of Wall Street. But how are the 1% reacting to all this bad publicity? We asked Doug Henwood of the Left Business Observer.
They haven't really paid very much attention. You know, you see the Wall Street Journal does a story about it every day, but as far as I can tell, it hasn't really entered market consciousness. They don't really perceive it as any more, they think, more than a curiosity at this point, surprisingly. Even looking at the Greek crisis, Wall Street's favorite economist, Ed Hyman, who is really, his virtue is tomorrow's conventional wisdom today, is very complacent about Greece. He thinks Greece will just roll over and finally take the austerity deal and doesn't seem to think that's either socially or economically difficult. Wall Street is still in a bit of a bubble.
Well, of course, Wall Street acts in many ways. It's wonders to perform. Some of it's in terms of stock trading and acquisitions and such. Other manifestations of what Wall Street thinks are expressed through its political representatives, some of them in the Democratic Party.
Nationally, I think some of the Democrats are in a pickle because the structural problem of the Democratic Party, it's a party of capital that has to pretend for electoral reasons that it's not. So whenever issues like that, the contradictions around issues like that, they are bent out of shape. So I think they don't really know what to do about it. It's a message that appeals to their base very much. Some of this stuff polls very, very well. Things like hating Wall Street, being worried about inequality and unemployment, and need to protect Medicare, Social Security, all that stuff scores very well in the polls. So, you know, if the Democrats were to embrace that, it would be good electoral news for them, but you know, their paymasters don't want them to do that. So some of the better people in the Democratic Party making strained and tortured noises about supporting the agenda, and I guess Obama will try to campaign off it in some sense, or you know, try to embrace it or dilute it or co-opt it or whatever, but I don't think that's going to be terribly successful. But I guess he'll try to do that. But you know, he's certainly not going to concede in any significant issues. You know. He'll push a small jobs bill, but nothing of the dimensions is really necessary.
Some elements of the Tea Party seem to be doing Obama's job for him by claiming that the Occupy Wall Street movement is an Obama concoction.
Yeah, well, you know, the American right is pretty crazy. We're constantly forced to choose between absolute lunatics like the Republican Party and servants of empire in Wall Street like Barack Obama. It's a terrible situation to be in. Obama's going to have trouble running against Romney. You know, if there were some right-wing guy, he would really quite like that because the public just doesn't want some crazy right-wing guy. The Democrats love the Tea Party and all those lunatics because they make the Republicans look like such insane losers. But somebody like Romney, who is, you know, in most ways very little different from Obama, it would be hard for him to run against him. So I suppose for electoral reasons, he'd have to try to run to Romney's left, which would be a curious thing to watch.
But in a Romney-Obama contest, how has the Occupy Wall Street phenomenon changed the lay of the land, raised expectations?
Well, it certainly raised expectations. One hopes that the better Democrats would be energized to do something mildly better. I mean, that's certainly what, you know, under the current arrangement, that's what one hopes for, and God knows what will happen over the longer term. So I guess that, you know, the Democrats are going to talk and campaign on doing something about inequality and jobs. It'll be small, but I guess that's what they're going to have to, just to brand themselves. I think a couple of polls of the people at Zuccotti Park, and a lot of them are disillusioned Obama supporters. And I wonder, a year from now, with the threat of a Republican winning the presidency, whether a lot of them wouldn't come back. We're going to hear, I think, a lot of pressure to do that over the next year, for sure.
So, in other words, the moment of truth has not yet arrived for the occupation movement.
Yeah, well, that's the question. In the 2008 election, you know, I said one of the major reasons to want to see Obama win is that it would produce some kind of disillusionment. And people would say, you know, it's not just personnel, it's the system. I hope that perception, which has finally seemed to be coming to pass, is strong enough to meet the pressures of 2012. The only good thing you could say about Obama being reelected is if a Republican won, then a lot of this would turn into, oh, we got to get the Republicans out. So there's a virtue in having a Democrat in office and things still sucking.
Doug Henwood, editor of the Left Business Observer in New York.
The homeless often have nowhere to go but outside in the parks. Now in many cities, they've been joined by legions of protesters. Jeremy Rosen, policy director of the National Law Center on Homelessness, says he hopes they are learning some real-life lessons.
Well, I think what's interesting about the Occupy movement is that the people who are part of that movement are now understanding what it means for and what it requires for the folks who were already homeless and were living on the street to actually get by, aside from thinking about the reasons that they've chosen to participate in the Occupy movement. People who are part of that movement are having to think of the practical matters like how are we going to stay warm on very cold nights or during a snowstorm, or where are we going to go to use the bathroom when we're living out here in public spaces. So I'm hopeful that many of the folks who are part of the Occupy movement are really gaining appreciation for what it means to live outdoors.
And one would think that would logically lead to concrete proposals or demands regarding homelessness and human habitational needs.
I certainly hope so. I'm certainly encouraged broadly by the view of the Occupy movement that something has to be done to address issues of inequality in U.S. society. Not sure that the movement has gotten to the point where they have very specific set of concrete policy proposals, but I think we certainly believe that they are calling attention to important issues, and that's a wonderful first step.
But you at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty do have concrete policy proposals.
Well, we certainly do. In terms of people living on the street, of course, we'd like to see everybody housed and nobody living outdoors, but we're very mindful, given the current reality that people are living outdoors. We spend a lot of time making sure that cities aren't making their lives harder, that cities are taking constructive steps to try to get people housed, or at least to provide people with sanitation, with safe places to stay, who are living outdoors, rather than actually criminalizing behaviors that people have no choice but to undergo, and arresting people, giving them criminal records, then spitting them out of the criminal justice system and right back to the street, making it even less likely that they're going to be able to get a job or get off the street if they have a criminal record.
And in fact, your executive director is calling for homeless people to occupy vacant buildings.
Well, we have certainly noted that the federal government and sometimes state and local governments, sometimes banks or mortgage companies in the foreclosure crisis, have a whole lot of property, much of it which is housing, that has no people in it. And then we have people who have no housing. So, you know, we are not necessarily calling for occupation of property outside the proper legal channels, but we certainly think it makes sense for our government to say, if we've got housing and there aren't people living in it and we've got people living on the street, we should find a way to match those up.
Lots of vacant housing, which previously were homes for poor and moderate income people, seem to be being warehoused for luxury apartments whenever the market changes.
Well, we're very concerned about that. There's a set of properties that are owned by banks. There are also a set of properties that the federal government has. They recently requested that groups offer proposals to the federal government, look at how they would potentially use about 100,000 foreclosed homes that the government owned. And there's certainly a number of private developers who have made proposals to the government saying, we want to take over that housing and use it as market rate housing for people. Our view is that much, if not all, of this housing should be used to provide homes for low-income families.
Well, we're not just talking about developers. Developers are all backed by banks, and it seems the banking model favors that kind of withholding of housing that actually exists from being used by people that need it.
Well, I think right now banks have foreclosed on many, many homes, and unfortunately, in many cases, what they're doing is post-foreclosure, they're looking to see how quickly they can make sure that the property is vacant, and then they're sitting on all of these vacant properties unable to sell them. We certainly believe that in many of these cases, if banks have to go through with a foreclosure at all, they should be recognizing that after the foreclosure, there ought to be some way to work with the people who are living there to stay on as tenants or to find other people to be tenants in the property at an affordable rate until a property can be sold so that these properties don't sit vacant.
Are proposals coming out of the Democratic Party, for example, that would actually facilitate the goals of your National Law Center?
Well, I think we're going to have to wait and see. Right now, I wouldn't say that either political party has made a particularly good set of proposals that would address our concerns. It'll be a real test to see what the government does with these 100,000 foreclosed homes that they're looking to get rid of. We've made it quite clear, along with many other organizations, that we think it's important to use many of them for affordable housing. We'll see if they make that decision or not.
That was Jeremy Rosen of the National Law Center for Homelessness in Washington. Thousands of federal prison inmates are in the process of getting early release on crack cocaine convictions. Glenn Ford has this commentary.
November 1 was a very good day for thousands of Americans, 85% of them black. That's the date when a 2010 law that reduced the disparity between sentences for crack and powder cocaine possession was made retroactive, making some inmates eligible for immediate release and knocking years off the prison time for many others. The Federal Bureau of Prisons has been processing requests for early release from prosecutors, judges, and public defenders across the country. Around 12,000 men and women should get some of their lives back, starting right now for nearly 1,900 of them. The bad news is the sentence reductions only apply to federal prisoners. Most drug offenders, including for crack, are held in state prisons, but we'll get to that a little later. When Congress passed the Fair Sentencing Act last year, it reduced the sentencing disparity for crack and powder cocaine from the previous 100-to-1 ratio to 18-to-1. That ain't justice, but it was all that the legislature of a profoundly racist country would allow. The change applied immediately to all newly arrested persons, but did not retroactively reduce the prison terms of those already convicted. Then, this summer, the U.S. Sentencing Commission decided to apply the law to those already serving time, unless Congress decided otherwise before November 1st. Congress wasn't deciding much of anything this session, but Attorney General Eric Holder argued that less than half the inmates, only about 5,500, should be allowed early release. Holder wanted to keep behind bars those he described as having significant criminal histories or who possessed weapons while committing their crimes of drug possession. The Sentencing Commission disagreed, believing that Holder was employing the same presumptive reasoning as lawmakers did when they passed the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act that mandated the same sentence for 5 grams of crack as for 500 grams of powdered cocaine. The assumption was that crack was an inherently more violence-producing drug than its chemically identical powdered form. Holder seemed to be saying the same thing in 2011, and so the Sentencing Commission rejected his argument. About 6,500 inmates are glad they did. But that's just a drop in the bucket for the vast American prison gulag. Most crack prisoners are held in state facilities. 13 states still discriminate between crack and powdered cocaine. According to a report of the Sentencing Project called Cracked Justice, Missouri hands down mandatory 10-year sentences for 6 grams of crack, the same as for 450 grams of powder, a 75-to-1 disparity. Oklahoma enforces a 6-to-1 ratio for a minimum 10 years for 5 grams of crack. Arizona's disparity is 12-to-1, and less than 1 gram of crack will get you 5 years in prison. The same logic prevails now as back in 1986, that crack is a more violent substance than powder. We all know, of course, that the crime is actually judged by who is holding the dope, not the dope itself. The crack-cocaine disparity is a legalistic expression of a racial slander, that blacks are inherently more prone to violence than whites. It is a logic that much of the Congressional Black Caucus bought into back in 1986, and that the black U.S. Attorney General behaves as if he believes today. The national policy of mass black incarceration could not long continue if it did not have lots of black collaborators in high places and low.
Irvington, New Jersey is almost an all-black city of about 60,000, bordering Newark, and a center of the home foreclosure crisis. Residents and supporters braved a snowstorm to protest foreclosures and to call for more jobs and better health care. David Hungerford is one of the organizers.
New Jersey as a state is really very heavily harmed by the explosion of the housing bubble, the overpricing of the home market that took place from the late 90s through 2009. And in New Jersey, Essex is one of the worst. And in terms of these kinds of economic conditions, of course, they are particularly concentrated on black people. Irvington is a 95% black community, African-American, Haitians, and Latin American people. It was particularly victimized by abusive subprime lending, predatory lending to the max. So it's been very hard hit by foreclosure. And this is entirely the responsibility of the lending institutions and the financial system as a whole. Let me mention also that as well as the mortgage problems, for other reasons due to the general economic crisis, property taxes have been rising rapidly, so even people who've been hanging on by their fingernails are also being threatened by rises in property taxes now. So, and all of these things are worse in Irvington and Essex County and other communities.
We're talking about communities being overpriced. What we seem to have here is a situation in which the overpricing has endangered a huge proportion of the homeowners in that community, and that could lead to a total economic makeover of the demographics of this community.
Certainly it has led to a great deal of eviction and speculation. Small speculators will move in and, pick up foreclosed properties at a song, and a good deal of that has gone on. And of course, it's very destructive. I mean, it's very harmful to the people who have been foreclosed and introduces a whole lot of instability in the community very often. For instance, another effect of fallout is that tenants will be displaced, even though under New Jersey law, if there is foreclosure, the bank or whoever acquires the property simply becomes the new landlord. But and the tenants can't be displaced for that reason, but very often they don't know their rights, and very often, they do end up being displaced one way and another. So this is another harmful effect of foreclosure.
And how have the people of Irvington reacted to this threatened dislocation?
I think they responded very well to the work of our coalition to save our homes, which is made up of a number of local groups. It was founded by the People's Organization for Progress. But, we've had very good community responses to our program. We are not a service organization, Coalition to Save Our Homes, that is. We don't have those kinds of resources. We
support people who offer services to distressed homeowners, but that can only make the best of a bad situation. Our focus instead is to look at the source of this catastrophe, which is the overpricing of the home market by the financial system. And prices were fixed. It was, you know, the market was rigged, and price fixing is illegal. But it was done by these huge, immensely powerful institutions, you know, banks and mortgage lenders and other branches of the financial system. And they seem to be, too big to be prosecuted for swindling people. But we don't see things that way. We've been circulating a petition and raising the demand that the banks swindled people and that they should be prosecuted. And the penalty upon conviction would be that they would have to reduce mortgage principals by the amount of overpricing. So if a house that was really worth only $180,000 got sold through price fixing for $300,000, and that's a totally representative example, then the mortgage principal would have to be reduced by $140,000. That the lender has no claim on it because it was a swindle. So that's been our approach, and we've gotten very good support.
But who would effectuate this prosecution?
Well, as I said, price fixing is against the law. And, who is supposed to enforce the law is the Attorney General of New Jersey, Paula Dow. Certainly if some small swindler were found to have been operating in such a way, they would get prosecuted. So we want the Attorney General, Paula Dow, to prosecute the mortgage lenders for price fixing with the penalty that we have demanded, that the mortgages be reduced to reflect a true market value. We have been circulating a petition. We've got more than 700 signatures on it at this point to the Attorney General. And at the appropriate point, we will go to her and present that demand. And we do expect that she will prosecute them because they did break the law.
And this could create a model, not just for Irvington, but for lots of other cities.
Yes. In fact, there's one precedent in Massachusetts already. Recently, a single mortgage lender was sued by the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Martha Copley. The basis of the prosecution was that the lender had contracted mortgages with people who it knew or should have known could not possibly repay the mortgages. So, this was abusive lending, and because the loans were contracted on that faulty business model where they knew the borrowers could not repay, the lender was required to lower the number of mortgages by a total of $125 million. So that's good precedent already for what we are attempting. It shows legally we are on good grounds here. We just want to take a little farther. Massachusetts prosecuted, on the basis of people who could not possibly repay the mortgages. There are other people who can repay the mortgages, but they still, suppose you can repay that $300,000, but $120,000 is, you're just not getting any value. So we want to build on that precedent. We'll take that principle as quite valid and go a little further that even in the case of the borrower who contracted the mortgage they can pay, if it's for too much, it still has to be reduced.
How important is community action in addition to this legal approach?
Oh, the legal approach means nothing without community action. The Attorney General isn't going to do it out of the goodness of her heart. We have to bring all kinds of pressure, and particularly the mass pressure from the base of the people who've been harmed by this activity by the lenders is the key ingredient. It's primarily, we're not taking a legal approach. Primarily, we're taking a power to the people approach. It might seem unimaginable that small community groups can build and grow and challenge the most powerful institutions of United States society, but stranger things have happened, and we're perfectly serious about making this happen. We will make it happen.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.